Hello, friends, and welcome to Backstory. I'm James D'Amato, and I'm filling in for Alex while she's sick. A quick reminder that Starcrossed is launching on Kickstarter very soon. On April 10th, you'll be able to back Alex's hotly anticipated two-player RPG of Forbidden Love. Be sure to follow at BullyPulpit_HQ on Twitter, or go to BullyPulpitGames.com for more information. Side note, Starcrossed is my actual favorite game right now. If you're even a little bit interested, I highly recommend you check it out. Alex's guest today is Liz Chypredicou, owner of Angry Hamster Publishing, best known for the dark fantasy RPG Witch, Fated Souls. She has a new game on Kickstarter right now, the all-ages card-based RPG, Familiars of Terra. Alex and Liz talked about her latest game, the ups and downs of independent publishing, and how we're all just making it up as we go along. Let's jump right in.
We should talk about the fact that you've been working for a long ass time for absolutely everybody in the RPG industry. Like, it kind of blows my mind that you just like have worked for absolutely everyone.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I was trying to update my portfolio a couple days ago and I just realized that it was completely untenable to do so. with everything that's in process and things that are going on, and I just stopped. But yes, I've been working the past 2 years. I've kind of been like head down working for a bunch of people and just trying to get some experience, you know, since like Witch was my first solo book and really like, you know, kind of like stepping my toe into the industry, so to say. And then I decided to just dive in and get as much experience as possible. So yeah.
That's interesting. What do you find that you learn from working with like lots of different publishers?
Well, I mean, like when you publish your own game, you're not designing in a bubble, obviously, because you're playtesting it and you're getting feedback from people. And, you know, so that whole process is happening. But when you do work for other people, they hold you to different standards. You know what I mean? They hold you to different standards than fans do, or, you know, the general public. They have certain goals that they want to meet. They have certain ways of working. So just learning how people do things differently is just like a huge benefit. You know what I mean? Like I find it a little bit hard to explain even, you know what I mean? Like it just learning different ways of working makes you better.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I feel like that applies to so many different, especially creative fields. One thing that I noticed when I was working as a freelance writer for you, which was like a while ago, actually, like it was one of the first things that I worked on, is the,
oh my gosh.
But yeah, no, I worked on the Witch Fated Souls North America supplement that just came out. And it was such a good, healthy process that I was like, man, this is like really solid. Like, I love working with Liz. And it makes so much sense now that if you yourself are a freelance writer, you kind of know how to treat your folks that work for you and how to like make that a productive relationship. I wonder if you can like share some of like your best practices.
Yeah, for sure. I think like, I mean, for me, it's really important that you have a good conversation with the people you work with. You know, it was interesting, when I went into working with freelancers, and I don't know if it's just because I picked very excellent people to work with from my own company, but everyone always was really communicative and really would, you know, tell me if they couldn't make a deadline or ask questions and stuff like that. And when I got into some other companies, I realized that wasn't the case. So one of my best practices is just to like create a friendly environment where people feel like they can tell you things. And, you know, that is, I think it's so underrated because everyone's trying to be so professional. And of course, you want to be professional and you want people to know that, you know, their work is valued in that way. But if you don't have an open rapport with the people you're working with on such a creative level, I mean, it's very difficult to achieve that, you know, as a company. So that's definitely one of my best practices.
Do you find that like a hard balance to kind of strike between being the, you know, the client who has certain business needs that need to be met versus like knowing that you need to have that human element in order to have a good relationship with the person?
Yeah, I mean, I think it also it's difficult depending on the scope in which you want to do. So like if we take Faded North America, for example, what you wrote, I was really happy to have you pitch to me. I'm like, you know, tell me about where you live, because I have no idea.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much for hiring a Canadian. Like, it didn't have to be me, but I'm just glad you hired a Canadian to write about North America. That just made me so happy.
But I mean, yeah. And so I think, like, you know, you know what you're writing. You know, like, I pick people who are competent, right? And I pick people who I believe are creative and talented. So that's already half the battle, right? And then, you know, the other half is just making sure that you're clear, you know, as a manager, about deadlines and expectations and stuff like that. And then I think everything else you can kind of work through, you know, everything else in terms of like deadlines or, oh, maybe this writing style isn't exactly what I was expecting. You know, those are very easy things to fix. But if you don't have the basics there, you know what I mean? If you don't have a person you believe in, and you haven't been clear with that person and what you expect from them, then it's going to be really difficult to get the results you want.
Yeah, definitely. Where do you find artists and writers and people that you are excited to work with?
I do a lot of not really stalking on the internet. the healthy version of that. You know, like I think like a lot of us in the industry, I am a big fan of things like podcasts and YouTube and blogs, especially when I have a writing block and I feel like I can read a blog instead of actually writing, and that's technically still working. So, you know, I find a lot of people that way and through my network. And art is just a lot of searching. And anytime I'll literally be on my phone and I'll see someone post something randomly on Facebook, like, this person's awesome. And then I'll pin it and I'll save it for later just because I know I want to follow up and see who this person is because they make cool things. And then I manage to just find really cool people kind of out of the woodwork.
Yeah. Well, I think that sounds like looking before you need rather than finding a need and then being like, oh God, I need someone.
Well, yeah, for sure. I mean, like, also just because like people are doing so many cool things. So every time I see something that someone does and they like really inspire me, I'm like, oh, I want to work with that person. You know what I mean? Like maybe not ever, but like if I could, that would be awesome.
Yeah, definitely. I know that feeling of like the sort of, the aspirational to work with, like, oh, someday I'm going to have the project that, you know, this artist will be a good fit for.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. My dream art page, you know.
So we can talk more about Witch Faded Souls, which is like your dark fantasy RPG. Then you founded a publishing house specifically to publish it initially, Angry Hamster Publishing. And I'm wondering, like, what motivated you to get it out there like that? Like, why not shop it around to publishers?
Yeah, well, I mean, at that time, like, my main experience with kind of the professional writing industry was through Wizards of the Coast. And so I had done a couple of things for them, but that's still very far off. I hadn't been to any American conventions. I didn't have like this huge network of people. You know, I knew some Dutch people, that's where I live in the Netherlands, who are part of the industry, but it was like, I can't ask Wizards of the Coast to publish this because, yeah, right? Yeah. And I can't ask Paizo to publish this because, no. So, you know what I mean? I was like, oh, well, then I'll just self-publish it because this work needs to be out there and I want it to enter the world. And that's honestly just how it started. And I was like, let's do it. You know, it's been long enough that I've been dreaming about it. And yeah. Yeah, at one point you get tired of dreaming and you want to do it.
Yeah, totally. Well, thinking back on that, is that a route that you would recommend to other people generally?
You know, if you know other people in the industry, I would recommend getting a little more experience with indie publishing first than I had when I started, simply because I think that I could have saved myself a lot of heartaches. If I had known what I knew now, yeah. You know what I mean? And, you know, that just comes from working and experience. But then again, you know what I mean? Like, I also think that I also think there's something very liberating about just getting your product out there and seeing if people like it and pushing yourself to like the limit and yeah, just getting it out there and publishing if you want to do that. But I think, you know, that does take a certain amount of humility. So it's, you learn some hard lessons.
Yeah, definitely. Well, what was, like, give me an example. What was one lesson that you learned during that first, you know, publishing a big thing like that?
Hire a proofreader. Hire a proofreader. They are worth their weight in gold or in platinum or in like gold press platinum for the Star Trek nerds out there. Like, I mean, you just, I mean, hire a proofreader if it's the last thing you do. And I think, you know, realize that, you know, you're already successful. The fact that you've finished a book, and if you manage to get it kickstarted, and even if there's like 50 people reading your book, you're a success, and actually enjoy yourself. Because I think a lot of people don't do that, or at least I didn't take a moment to realize what I had accomplished. And I just kept going because I wanted to be a success. And when I look back on it, I think that's so silly, because I was like, Liz, even if 20 people read your book, at least it's 20 people you don't know reading your book, you know, like give yourself a pat on the back before you go, you know, full head in, you know, into the industry.
Yeah, definitely. Is that something that you're trying to cultivate more now? And do you think that you're successful at it?
I mean, definitely. Like I think that I take small victories now. And I just think that the industry is so hard, you know, because I think we're struggling. The industry is still struggling in a way to become legitimized in terms of, like, you know, mainstream, like things like Stranger Things help and, you know, all the cool Geek and Sundry stuff. But I mean, the roleplay industry still is kind of a little bit fringe. But within the industry, I think that like people are really trying to make it. I think it's important. And I think I do take smaller successes now, mainly because I think when you start out, you're just very hard on yourself. And I'm not so hard on myself anymore because I realize that, like, you know, everyone's just trying their best and you're only human. And that's just hard to learn when you want to do so well and you want to get your stuff out there and you want people to like what you're playing. Because ultimately, I think that we make games so people have fun, right? And when someone tells you, oh, I'm not having fun with what you've created, that's really hard. So take your successes where you can get them.
Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely one thing that you learn from working with lots of different folks and from having connections to lots of different folks in the industry, is to be less hard on yourself, because it's so easy to think that everyone else is doing it perfectly.
Well, yeah. And like, you know, and we live like these digital lives where like everything is so curated. So like no one sees the fact that like I'm walking to the supermarket in my pajamas halfway through writing something in the midst of a nervous breakdown. You know what I mean? Like no one sees that, but they do see me post like a cute picture on Facebook with my newest 7C book. You know what I mean? Like, so it's just so, you have to remember how curated our lives are, you know?
Yeah. What's that saying that like you're seeing everybody else's highlight reel and you're seeing your own bloopers and
yeah. Exactly. Oh my God.
One thing I have to say is going to like the Angry Hamster Publishing website and just seeing the faces of three women looking back at me kind of had an impact on me. Yeah. Did you deliberately, well, I mean, it's not like it's front page or whatever, but I mean, on the about page, do you think that they're like, I find that it kind of rules working with other women just personally, but is that something that you were specifically like, yeah, that's something that I want to be a feature of this publishing house? Or did that just happen because that's the folks that you were interested in working with?
I think it started out just because they were people that I was interested in working with. You know what I mean? Like with all the supplements that we have for Witch, for example, they're all written except for one by extremely talented ladies. And so it started out kind of just because I'm like, these people are awesome and I want to work with them. And then I was like, oh, this is kind of cool what we have here. So, you know, like we definitely have guys on the team. It just so happens that there's only like two of them ever so often. And otherwise, it's a bunch of ladies. And, you know, it is very like, it's a very different working environment than I'm used to. But like, I love it so much.
Yeah, totally. What else can you tell me about the structure of your publishing house? And what kind of changes have you made in that company, you know, since that first Kickstarter that you think have made it successful?
Well, I mean, it used to just be me. And then I realized that, like, maybe I need some help. That was another, like, best practice is just, like, get some help. Don't do this alone. And I had actually met Steffi, who is kind of, like, my co-partner now. Originally, it was another good friend of mine, but she had a full-time job, so she just couldn't commit. Originally, I had met Steffi who is a partial owner of the company now, through freelancing for Onyx Path Publishing. And I met her because I was like, hey, your last name sounds Dutch. Are you Dutch? And she's like, yes. I'm like, okay, we should know each other because, like, are we the only two here in Holland? Turns out we're not. So like just adding Steffi onto the team, like she is so amazingly creative. She has been freelancing for a very, very long time, and I'm happy to now push her forward and make her develop a bunch of stuff for our company, or ask her politely to develop a bunch of stuff for our company. And then Carol is the best. Carol is our copy editor and makes sure that everything makes sense and that we're not saying that one event happened on 50 different dates and things like that. So,
oh yeah, I guess that's something, because Witch has a lot of like established lore. Yeah, wow. How do you keep that kind of thing consistent?
A really big Google Doc. It's like the worst thing ever. We just had a meeting about this, and Steffi and I were like, we're going to take colored post-it notes and we're going to put them on the wall and we're going to try to figure this out, because as we expand the universe, we've realized that like things might be contradictory or might not, or maybe we've done that on purpose, but like we need to map it out. But right now it's a Google Doc and that's about it. It's like not as fancy as I hoped it would be, but yeah.
No, thank you. This is what we're talking about, right? It's not all the highlight reel.
No, exactly. Like, it's a Google Doc with a lot of notes of just like, this doesn't make sense. What were you thinking, Liz? And that's normally the note from me. Yeah. And then Steffi's like, oh, it makes sense because of this. And I'm like, oh, yes. Good. That's why you're here, because you're the smart one, you know?
I love that. Yeah. Asking for help can be really, really hard in, like, I think maybe especially in an industry where it's easy to feel isolated because it's so like small and so many of us are working remotely and you kind of feel like you have to be able to do everything, but that's really good to have folks around to be working with.
Yeah. And I know. And I mean, like, it's also isolating, right? Because like everyone seems like they can do everything. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you meet everyone, it's like, I've done my, like, I do the writing and development and I do the art and I do the layout. And then you're like, oh, crap, you are much higher than I am. Like, you, like, I cannot ask this question to you, you know, like, it's a difficult speed bump kind of or hurdle to cross over. And then you realize that everyone's just kind of having to do their own thing, because like, they're indie publishers and they have to do it. Yeah,
they,
you know,
can't afford anything else. So it's, they're not just like so amazingly talented. It's just like, well, this is how I do it.
Yeah, it's like, I have no money for a layout artist. So this is me in InDesign crying at 12 o'clock in the morning. You know,
the glamour.
Yeah.
You know, we've talked about some of the struggles, but like, what is your favorite thing about working in independent RPG publishing?
I think the ability to just, after all the projects I've done, still be surprised by people in a very positive way, like how creative people are. You know, like I can't even grasp it sometimes. You know what I mean? Like, I'm always so proud when certain books come out and I've had nothing to do with them. I'm like, such a good book, like Blades in the Dark. I played it for the first time at Origins last year and I was like floored. And I'm like, and I somehow felt ownership of that, even though I had done absolutely nothing to make this game a success and had only played it ever once. But like, I love that about working at the industry, you know what I mean? And playing in the industry and being part of it, that you can just play this one game that stays with you and it's like magical, you know? And that never gets old.
Yeah, absolutely. And you get to have that experience, like seeing, you know, a game that's come out, and that can be amazing to just look at and be like, oh, wow, what brilliant mechanics. But you also just get to experience that at the table, like other players being so amazingly, unbelievably creative.
Yeah, or people like thinking of, yeah, amazing things. Like when people play Witch, for example, they'll be like, oh yeah, but my headcanon is basically that, you know, actually the Preetas, and they'll be talking about like the different demons. And I'll just secretly be taking notes in my mind. I'm like, yes, that's how I meant it. Exactly like how you said. But really, like, no. But like, I mean, it's so creative, right? And you just think like, you got that from my game. Like, that is really special. You know, that really means something to me.
Yeah. Do people take your games in ways that you were like totally not expecting and follow up? Is that fun or not?
I've had it. I mean, people have taken my game, like Witch, for example, is a pretty dark game, but I always imagined that it was kind of a hopeful game too, because you had the possibility to regain your soul. You know what I mean? And for me, that's a very hopeful thing. It's kind of like, try your hardest, drama, drama, drama. But at one point, you know, there is this possibility of kind of freedom, right? Like it's that search for redemption, which is so tempting, you know, the hero's journey, even if you die doing it, it's still like a hopeful story. And some people have taken Witcher like very dark. And like, you know, I like that. You know what I mean? I think if people are enjoying themselves, then I'm not the person to say how they should enjoy themselves. You know what I mean? Like I had this conversation actually with my friend who designed indie games, and her and I were talking about whether or not you should put in your book that people can just throw out your rules and make up their own rules. And she was very much under the opinion. She's like, don't apologize for your game design. You put those rules in there and they should be used. You know, I really like, you know, and her and I, we were just kind of going over like, you know, what the thought process behind that was. And I was like, actually, I think I still want that in there. You know, like I very much think that if the only thing you get from Witch is that you think it's a really cool theme that like people sell their souls and you want to use some Apocalypse World rules for this and you're just cutting the art out of the book and you're enjoying yourself, like good for you, you know? Like, I feel like that's kind of the spirit, right, of the indie community. Like, I don't want to put anything down on someone. I don't know. Like, do you feel the same way in your game design? Like, am I crazy?
You know, I'm glad that you put that so, like, eloquently and lovingly, because I think prior to you asking, like, I kind of do feel that way. Like, I don't always like reading rules that are like, do this or don't. And then do this or don't. Hey, it's your life, man. You know, like I want to see that confidence. But I'm also someone who I think if that wasn't made explicit and I wanted to hack it, I probably just like would. And I would never feel like I'm doing it wrong or whatever. And so I think maybe there are some players that need that kind of permission or that maybe wouldn't have thought about it or maybe like worried about doing it wrong. Like, man, some players are super, super worried about doing it wrong.
Yeah. I you know, like, and I don't know if that also comes from like, I've done a lot of convention plays over here of Witch, and that's kind of where it came from. Like where I was just like, you know, like I'm going to put this in here one time. I'm not going to repeat it, but at the starting mechanics section, it's going to say, do whatever you want if you don't think this works. Because, you know, like I got a lot of questions like, yeah, but like, can I do this? And I'm like, you can do whatever you want. It's magic. You know, like, and magic is awesome. You know, like it might be difficult and you might have obstacles in your way. And I'm pretty sure your demon's going to want something from you. But like you as a player, like as a non-player character entity, you can, as long as you agree with your GM and your table, you can do whatever you want, right? Like, I can't tell you what to do. I didn't put cameras in my books. You know?
Well, that's a funny thing too, right? Like people asking you directly, is this okay? I think people do want to, well, some people want to like respect the author, you know, like respect the intention. But once something is made, it's made.
Yeah. And then, but that's always, you know, that's always a question too. Like, where is that line? Like, where are you still respecting the game? And then where are you just like completely destroying the thought process behind it? But I don't know, like, can we define that? I don't really think you can, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the way that you talk about having this sort of collage approach of, hey, you know, here's my book, take from it what you want, whether it's the mechanics or the concepts or the world or whatever. I wonder if that is different than trying to play the game, but changing it. Like, are those two different things? You know, is there a difference between hacking and just like recreating? I mean, this is just the question of like remix culture, right?
I know. let's answer this in this segment. I'm sure you and I can get
to it. Yeah, definitively, probably, right?
I mean, I also think like what's difficult though, you know, is that like role-play games are in such a niche, right? Like it's not a board game, which has been around for a really long time, you know, where people can like objectively say like this one mechanic doesn't work because I can't climb up this ladder and that just doesn't work, right? And then you have like art, which is more subjective, but there's still rules on how to view it. And like, you know, you have comics, which is also kind of this in-between of literature and art, but still there's some, you know, widely accepted interpretations of things, like if you read Watchmen. But like, where is like the, you know, where's the definitive book on how to read D&D second edition? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. And also a game has to be experienced like mutually. I mean, there are some one player role playing games, but generally speaking, you are trying to read something with a bunch of other people, and you all have, it has to work for everybody in order to work at all. So like, you can say, well, you know, I'm just going to sort of take it this way and you can take it that way. But when you're actually at the table with people, you do kind of have to be on the same level. And there's not that many art forms that are like that.
No. Yeah. Like that you have to come to a group consensus about how to attack it, basically.
Yeah. Like, I'm not standing at the art gallery next to somebody and being like, okay, so this piece, are we in agreement?
No. Can you imagine doing that? That would just be so terrible.
Picture like security guards at an art museum, except they come over to you and they're like, excuse me, are you interpreting this piece literally? I'm going to have to ask you to leave.
It's like, did you know you need to stand 2 meters away from it? Yeah. There's a line on the ground, miss. You know? that's also like sometimes what drives you crazy though, right? Like, you would never do that in art gallery, but like I play a lot of fifth edition D&D because that's, you know, a lot of my friends play it, and you know, I love Dungeons and Dragons. Unpopular opinion, I love it. I grew up with it, and you know, but like some of the discussions, like, yeah, but if you cast silence, it can't go, it's an orb and it can't go through a wall. And I'm like, are we all really discussing this right now? Like, is this the best product of our time? And we can only meet once a month because we all now have jobs and children and schedules and dogs and, you know, that's,
we're going to talk about the orb. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, we're going to talk about the orb. Like that's like 5 minutes of my life I can never get back.
I think that's especially true in like fantastical systems and systems with magic, where you're talking about like, can we do this or not? Like, I don't know. That just doesn't sound like the fun part. Like, bring me to the fun part and we can have a really intense discussion about what happens at the fun part, but not at the, you know, can I use shrink on this thing to make it small enough to fit into this other thing? Like, that's not going to be the fun part.
No, exactly right. Like, that's the part, that's the thing you kind of want to fast forward through. And I think you sometimes also forget that too when you've played too many games, right? Like, also maybe when you've designed too many games, you get really caught up on something. And then you realize you're like, why am I focusing on this? You know, like, let's get to the drama with like my demon lover.
Yeah.
That's so much better, you know?
Do you think that that your playstyle has changed a lot over the years?
Yeah. I care a lot less. is that bad to say? Like, you know, in university and like, you know, high school, university, like, you know, I would spend days writing like pages and pages of backstory, you know, and my GM would like read them. That would be the amazing thing. Like, they'd actually read it. And this was like terrible writing. Like, I can't express to you how bad it was. Maybe like one time I'll just send some to you and you can read it through and then, you know, print it out and burn it for this.
That would make me so happy.
but you know, now like I care more that I have a good time. So, and you know what I mean? Like, I do care about like my character's development and stuff like that. But I more care like when I sit down at this very moment, if I'm going to enjoy myself and my friends are going to enjoy themselves, rather than just being in that headspace of my character and being so in love with them. You know, I care more about the game than I do the character.
That is an interesting, I have not heard that phrase that way before. I care more about the game than the character. I wonder how much kind of like derailment and like blocking and like lack of good, interesting story comes from that instinct that I think a lot of players have to protect or defend their character, and not even necessarily to keep them alive, but just to make them a certain way, like to get attached to certain things happening to them or them behaving a certain way.
Yeah, like you have this kind of idea of who they are and you can't grow from that. But that also means your character can't grow, right? Or like they're only growing in the way that you're designing. But you know, it's also like if you have hours, right? Like if the only thing you have to do is to like, you know, you have a job at a bar, so it's fine because you can do that at night. And you only have to wake up like at 1:30 and your class is at 2 and you could spend the entire night role playing to get to the point where the group kind of agrees and has an interesting story, that's great. But if you only have like 4 hours at a convention, or because everyone has to go do something, I mean, I think you kind of have to let that go to a certain extent, because it does get in the way. You know, like, of course you could play your character, and you should, because I think playing a strongish type character, at least, like, even if you're a waffly
play them strongly, type character, strongly waffling. Yeah, consistently waffling.
Yeah. Yeah, like, yeah, consistently waffling. Oh, no. Definitely. I've played that character before. I might be that character in my own life. Exactly. But, you know, like, I think, you know, that helps the role play. But to a certain extent, when you just have this ideal of who the person should be in your head and you're not willing to let go, I think that only really hurts the story, right?
Well, that's just thinking about, like, again, the point of playing, of engaging with a story in a way that is collaborative, right? Like, if you're super, super attached to really particular outcomes, I don't know, you write a story or just like spend some imagination time, which are not bad activities. They're extremely good, actually. I'm in favor of imagination time.
Yeah, exactly. And then like, and then if I dream, it's way better by myself anyway. Like, I don't need other people ruining the story that I'm thinking of. Like, stand back, everyone. I got this, you know?
Yeah, I'm in the middle of a daydream, if you don't mind. I do have to attend to this. Jeez, you know, something we should get to is the Kickstarter thing that you are going to have running by the time that this episode drops, Familiars of Terra. You must be excited and terrified right now.
Basically, existential dread has sunk in.
Cool.
No, I am excited. Like, Familiars of Terra is such a thematic departure from Witch. I mean, like, there's magic in the sense that there's animals that can evolve to do cool things, but it's like not dark. It's really happy. Children can probably play this game. Well, can play this game to great happiness, you know? So it's very different than Witch. And yeah, like, I am very excited and very scared. I hope our fans, and I hope there's enough audience for it, which I think there is, but you know.
What are some of your inspirations for Familiars of Terra? Because it feels very unique, and yet at the same time, it has these very, I guess I'll say familiar elements.
Sorry. I am using that pun a lot, and it makes me very happy. Yeah, so like, I started writing Familiars of Terra when Pokemon Go first started, came out. Like, it was already kind of an idea in the back of my head. And then I'm like, yeah, animals doing cool stuff. And that's kind of how it started. And then, you know, like, we took a lot of inspiration also from like his Dark Materials, like Golden Compass, if anyone's seen the movie, that type of stuff. And so that kind of melded into this world that we wanted to create, along with adding in some kind of real world analogies for like wars that have happened here and different cultures and things like that.
Okay. So like Witch, there is this kind of layer of fantastical on top of the real world. That's interesting. What kind of themes are you trying to invoke by doing that?
Well, I think like we, at least with Familiars of Terra, I wanted to make the fantastical seem very mundane to people in that world. So, like, of course there's animals everywhere. Like, of course everyone always has an animal familiar with them. Like, it's never questioned. And this kind of came from me developing other books for other companies, namely when I've been working with John Wick Presents, developing a couple of their books. Because, like, in the Seventh Sea books, we talk a lot about religion, right? And I myself am an atheist, so I tend to write, these people believe,
right?
You know, like, so-and-so believes. And actually, that's just very offensive. But I didn't realize that I was doing this until the editor's like, no, but this is true for them. And then that kind of all sunk in. Like, I had this kind of epiphany moment, and I was like, oh, that is very interesting. Like, what if that was a theme in a game I was writing, right? So like, we have this layer of magic over the world. So we do have something like spirits, you know, kind of like home spirits, like kami type creatures. And we do have animals who are your familiar and who can like grow wings and turn pink and shoot lightning. But it's all very mundane to people. What would that world look like, you know?
And how would people's experience of life change if they didn't have that really strong sort of distinction between like real and fantastical between like everyday and extraordinary.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, also, can you just imagine like knowing what an animal was thinking? You know what I mean? Like on that, like a cow, for example, like how would our life change in terms of like how we treat food or how we treat the environment or, you know, like what roads look like or where we leave our animals, you know, like it's just a, I mean, it's not like we don't get into these matters in a kind of serious way, so to say, like we tell you like what the world looks like and how it is. But like in a larger conversation, it's very interesting. You know what I mean? Like, how would we treat other creatures if we knew definitely, you know, scientifically or whatever, or spiritually, that, yeah, they were exactly like us almost, that we could, yeah, I don't know, where am I going with this? But it's just a weird thing to think about, you know?
Yeah, to imagine a different relationship with non-human animals.
Yes. Thank you. That is the eloquent, that is exactly what I wanted to say. Just cut that in with my voice,
please.
Call me
the summarizer. Love to summarize.
Summarizer. It's like the best masked hero ever. Like, the summarizer.
You won't appreciate me in battle, but during conversations, you'll be like, thank you. I feel very listened to.
Well, if you could summarize the combat, right? That'd be great.
Yeah, that helps.
No, but yeah. So like, what would that be like? And that's such a fun thing to build a world around, right? Like our world, but just slightly different. But then it kind of has a snowball effect, right? If you just change one thing, everything's different. You know?
I really like that too, because I think you can suddenly have the fun of a Pokemon scenario where you have these little cute animal pals who hang out with you, but while removing some of the kind of like disturbing sort of like cockfighting aspect, like perspective on Pokemon, where you are kind of like harvesting and using these animals to your own ends.
Okay, I know, keeping them little balls.
Like imprisoning them and just kind of Stockholm syndroming them a tiny little bit. I say that as someone who like loves Pokemon, but there are some dark undertones. So if Familiars of Terra is kind of like sidestepping that or subverting that a little bit, I think there's something really cool about that.
Yeah, I mean, like so in our game, right, you play a seeker, and seekers are kind of like a dying breed, so to say. They're heroes of yore in the modern world. So it's kind of the question, like, do we still need seekers? Do we still need people wandering around doing epic deeds? But alongside of your seeker story, and, you know, the accolades and things that they gain, your familiar also has its own story. So at one point, they get a legacy. And you get to develop a story with your GM about what they're going to become. So they also kind of get their own efficacy, so to say, and their own like epic ending to whatever story you're playing along with what your seeker has.
That's really neat. Yeah, the idea of, yeah, the companion having a story that is even greater than your own, like, or that, you know, is beyond what your story necessarily is. Oh, man, you're just decentering the human animal all over the place in this world. I'm totally into it. Mechanically, is Familiars of Terra like similar to Witch, or is it very different?
It's very, very different. So you use a deck of cards instead of dice.
What? That's so cool.
Yeah. So you, it's a really easy mechanic, basically. It's literally just drawing a card and seeing if you have above or below a certain stat that you have. But then the reason we wanted to use cards is I've been thinking a lot about, you know, like the dice mechanic. You know, I was thinking like, can you roll dice against each other? But I really wanted to evoke that kind of like card game, Pokemon, even Magic type feel. You know, Magic the Gathering, where you can like play down a bunch of cards and get cool combos and stuff like that. So like when you're familiar, because of course familiars fight, not humans, because humans are much more weak than familiars. You know, you can pull down these like devastating combos in coordination with your powers. So we decided to use cards instead of dice. So it's very different. It's a lot more simple than Witch, but there's a lot more. Like, for example, like for when your seeker gets more epic, you get things like titles and trophies. So you kind of become like Daenerys Stormborn Targaryen, first of her name, the Unburnt. Like, so you get that too. But every time you get one of these additional titles, it gives a mechanical effect to you because it's part of the story that you've played. So like if you liberate a group of hostages, maybe you're the liberator and then you're going to gain a piece of wisdom, which you can use once per game. So it's a little bit more intuitive, I would say, than Witch in terms of like how to use your skills.
Yeah. So is that strictly in the interest of dramatic effect? Because like truly playing cards, like you can get extremely kind of Yu-Gi-Oh doing that. Or does that have to do with making the game kid friendly?
I think a bit of both. I think like it is the dramatic effect, but also it allows for a little more fun, if that makes any sense, when you're playing at the table, because you can like kind of do sneaky things, like you can steal other people's cards or like look at the top. You can look at like the top 10 cards of their deck and like reorder them if you have a specific power. And that kind of brings in the kind of friendliness, because then you think about games like Go Fish, where you can ask someone like, hey, like, Alex, do you have an ace of hearts in your hand? I'll take that. Thank you very much. And so that it kind of makes the game more accessible.
Yeah, no, I agree with you about accessibility. And also, like, it's pretty easy to get your hands on a deck of cards. A lot of people have those, actually.
Exactly. And you know, I always, that's why I'm a big fan of various Apocalypse World games, just because, like, everyone has a set of D6s at their house. And you know, that's a really nice thing. Like, if you're not, like, a hardcore gamer, like, it's nice that you could just kind of pick up this book and, like, you know, you have a couple of D6s and you can just get into it without having to buy anything special. And that's the same thing with Familiars of Terror. Like, everyone has a deck of poker cards.
Or, you know, it's a dollar store thing, not a game store thing, necessarily. Although, I assume that there's going to be some kind of, like, beautiful stretch goal Familiars of Terror deck that will be like lovely and amazing.
Perhaps.
There's thoughts. There's rumors of such things.
There are thoughts, and we will talk more about that at the Kickstarter.
Ooh, secrets.
Seeing. Yes. I mean, I must say right now, I've been using my Laser Kittens deck, and the fact that Laser Kittens came out with a deck of kittens made me very, very happy. So I would be remiss, you know.
That's wonderful. One thing I wanted to ask you about is we worked on the same project a little while ago. You wrote something for the Threadbare RPG, which I think is just starting to ship out to backers now. Did you write an adventure?
No, I did a craft tutorial.
Oh, you were the one who did that? The make a scary doll? I mean, not necessarily scary.
But... Yeah, I did a doll's head dice bag. Oh. So I was busy for like, I think a week or so decapitating dolls in my house and making them beautiful, of course, and making them into dice bags. And Stephanie allowed me to do that, which was amazing.
Sometimes, you know, working in games is very good, actually. Sometimes it's extremely good.
Yes. I think it's like actually the coolest, like, specialist thing that I've done so far for anything that I've written for. I got to like do a craft tutorial. Like, what other game do you get to do that in, you know?
That's fun. I'm really looking forward to seeing more people play Threadbare now that it's kind of out there, because I really want people to bring doll. It's for our listeners. It's like a Stitch Punk game. It's about sentient toys. And God, I just want people to bring toys to the table, especially toys that they have made. Like, that's a good look.
Yes. Oh my, yeah, that would just be, and also because like no one will know, right? Like walking past, like people will know who know the game, but they'll just walk past with all these like hobbled together toys and a person with a sock, you know?
Yeah. Sock puppet. Like, hello, I'm on my way to my game. Thank you very much.
It speaks so much to like also like that those things you did as a childhood, like as a kid. My mom has this Inuit doll, and it's kind of like a family heirloom type thing. And she gave it to me when I was like, I don't know, I'm going to say 6 to give myself some leeway so people don't think I'm a monster. And I just, you know, I thought she was pretty. But I was really bothered that her eyebrows had been, that her eyebrows had been kind of wiped off with age. So I decided to take a permanent marker and draw on her eyebrows. And then, like, after that, it just went downhill. Because then I was like, you know, her dress needs some, oh gosh. And my mom just came home and she was like so angry. And I was so happy with my little monstrosity. Like, I was like, aww, she's beautiful. And so I feel like if I ever went to one of these games at a convention, I would have to dig up this poor, like, disgraced doll.
Oh my gosh, yeah. If you still had that, that would be supreme.
Oh, it's so sad. And like, I tried, like my mom was so upset. Like I really tried to get the permanent marker off, but it just doesn't work. But then it just adds to her creepiness now because like she has like half eyebrows with like black smudges over her face. I mean, it's
that, yeah, I feel like almost every, at least most of the women I know as kids, like chopped all the hair off of their Barbies or like just, yeah, people really do messed up stuff to dolls. That's, I don't know why. And then we find them creepy later in life. And it's like, well, you know what you did.
I know. It's just like, it's like little Sally experiments with taking down the patriarchy one Barbie at a time. You know?
Like, yeah.
It's like, I will cut all her hair off. She feels beautiful without it. You know?
Who cares what Ken likes?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, Ken's going to have
this is easier to take care of.
Exactly. You know, and Ken can wear her skirt if he wants to, you know?
It's fun to play with dolls.
It is. It is.
More, and I think, doll stuff in games, actually. Like, we're all playing pretend anyway. So, like, whatever. Embrace it, people.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Bring your sock to the table.
It's not that different than your mini. Be real.
No, I know. I know. I had it. I had it, like, I always used, I used to use a Hello Kitty for my mini.
Yay!
So, I was like, you know what? I have pink dice. None of these minis look good. Hello Kitty looks better.
It has to match.
So when I play D&D, I'd always use Hello Kitty, because why not?
I also, I appreciate that it's like regardless of the like race or class that you're playing, you use Hello Kitty, like human, mage, orc, fighter, like whatever. It's Hello Kitty on the inside.
Yeah, because like she's sassy, she's cute, you know, she's like intelligent when she wants to be. But do you know that actually Hello Kitty is actually a little girl in a cat suit?
Okay, yeah. I had that bomb dropped on me. Like the creator of Hello Kitty just like had this really ambiguous public statement that was like, no, Hello Kitty is not a cat. She is a human girl. And like didn't clarify it any further. And it's like, what are you talking about? I love that how much mystery and confusion that adds to the concept of Hello Kitty.
Yeah, like what? Yeah, I know. But also just like, what is, and it really needs a role play game, right?
So you have been, okay, I shouldn't, but yeah, I've been working on this. Well, thinking about a Sanrio, like a bootleg Sanrio RPG.
I would love that. If you need freelancers, let me know.
Oh my gosh, you'd be the first. You'd be the first, Liz.
It's like, I understand, Alex. What would that world look like? Like, all these people walking around like cats.
Yeah, like tiny little dogs. Weird animals and like cute little dog boys. And like, there are so many Sanrio characters that like never really got big outside of Japan. And they're kind of like the D-list that are like a gentleman duck and like an airplane guy. And like all these like kind of just like baffling things, like a gorilla lady, like what? Like they're very good. They're actually extremely good.
There's a new one, right? There's like they made like this metal head.
Oh, a Gretsuko. Yeah.
She's amazing.
She's very cool because she's like keeps it cool at the office. She's an office lady and like has to be nice to people all day, but then she loves metal, and when it all comes out, it all comes out.
Exactly. Like, I think that even the video they posted, wasn't she like drinking too? Like,
oh,
like,
yeah,
she's hardcore. I like her, you know.
Yes, excellent. You can be a Gretzko when we play the bootleg Sanrio RPG that I will definitely make and suffer no negative consequences via the Sanrio Corporation.
No, this is in no way is anything like Sanrio, even though there's all these people.
Even though it's explicitly called that, and I have used the names of all of your characters, including the ones that you forgot about.
Yeah, exactly. It's like title of RPG. This is not Sanrio.
Yeah. Pom Pom Purin is here for his own reasons. You can't tell him what to do.
He's going through some things.
He loves me better.
Oh, no.
Okay. I feel like we should probably wrap up soon. You know what? The one last question that I want to ask you just comes from the fact that I think a lot of people, like I've heard at panels and stuff, ask about, how do I get into the RPG industry? How do I start? And it's kind of like a Narnia thing where it's like, well, no one who is there even knows. But I really dig that you're just like incredibly prolific, and I've worked for like big names, tiny indie shops, like other people, your own stuff. So my question to you is, how do you turn work into more work? How are you on that hustle? What is your hustle method?
So I've always treated freelancing in the role play industry like I would treat a job in an office that I really wanted. And I think sometimes people don't do that. They forget to do that. So when you apply for something, you know, like a week after, if I haven't heard, I write like, hey, thank you so much, you know, for taking in my application. If there's any other information you want to know, please let me know. And, you know, when I'm done a project, like, hey, I really enjoyed this. Like, if you have any feedback for me, I would love to hear your feedback. I'm always trying to grow. And also, like, I really enjoyed working with your company. If you have any other work, please let me know. And a lot of devs who work for bigger companies who have a couple things going, if you're polite, if you're on time, if you make your deadlines and you do good work, or at least you're willing to take feedback and you take their feedback well and produce a successful piece, like, you know, they'll be like, hey, actually, I do have something, like, thanks for asking. And that really has been kind of invaluable to me, just like being grown up, being responsible and being there and checking your ego. Like,
that's really hard sometimes, you know, when you're really passionate about what you do. How do you take feedback well?
That's difficult. I don't know. Like, I always just assume other people are right. Like, maybe I'm the wrong person to ask about this, but like, the thing is that, like, at least this is my perspective, right? Like, if someone has actually, assuming everyone is a good person,
okay,
and they're not just out there to make you feel bad, right? Then someone has taken time to give you feedback on something, because they actually genuinely care about the product or they care about you. So to completely ignore that or to let that hurt you and not think that it can only come from a place of wanting to help you or wanting to make something better is just extremely like hurtful to yourself, right? Like you're hurting yourself thinking that way. And you really shouldn't, because this person is probably, they care enough to give you feedback.
That's a really good perspective. Yeah, feedback as gift. Right? And feedback as offer of help.
But saying that, like, you know, if you feel really strongly about something, like, please let your editor know. I've been wrong a lot. You know, like, I'll, you know what I mean? I'll just go through and I'll comment. I'm like, this doesn't make sense. Like, why are you doing it this way? And like, shouldn't you do it this way? And then like, I'll have a writer come back like, no, but it does make sense because of this, this, and this. And then somehow you can come to kind of a middle way. But like, you know, if you really do believe in what you're writing and you think that the feedback is unfounded, or at least you think that the feedback has, or the person reading has missed something because, like, you know, editors aren't infallible, then like, you know, let them know and like work it out.
No, that's nice. Yay. Give and take.
Yeah.
This all ties into what we said at the beginning about just like cultivating a healthy relationship. That's really, I think that's a lovely note to end on. If my listeners want to keep up with you and the projects that you're working on, what's the best ways for them to do that?
You can go to our website, which is angryhamsterpublishing.com. And you can also follow us on Facebook, Angry Hamster Publishing, and on Twitter, Angry Hamster RPG.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. This was like a really, really, really fun chat. I'm glad we're able to schedule it and make it work.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This was really, I didn't expect us to go into Hello Kitty, but I really enjoyed it.
I love that we went there. I love that we weren't afraid to go there. You know, like this is the...
Should never be afraid to go there.
I'm trying to inspire people, Liz, you know, with this kind of work.
Thanks again to Liz for joining us, and as always, thank you for listening. If you have thoughts on today's episode, you can always email backstorypodcast@gmail.com or tweet to @backstorycast. Backstory is part of the One Shot Podcast Network. You can go to oneshotpodcast.com for more great gaming shows like Campaign. Campaign is an Edge of the Empire actual play show that's nominally about Star Wars, but is actually just 3 men and a baby in space. Join host Kat Cool as she attempts to tell a coherent Star Wars story around some Chicago improvisers. The music for Backstory is provided by Yujiko, and the track is called Thinking of You. You can find Yujiko's music on SoundCloud, Spotify, YouTube, and more. Talk to you later, friends.